You're listening to Midori House, which was first broadcast on the 28th of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One with me, Ted Kravitz. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, could it be the end of an era in Colombia as the government edges towards a ceasefire with the FARC rebel militia? We hear from the Colombian ambassador to the UK. Also, Norway says sorry to the victims of Utøya Island and the Oslo bombings at the hand of Anders Breivik. We hear how the prime ministers promised to improve Norway's civil defences. And we talk to Australian children's book author and illustrator Sean Tan about his influences and ideas from a background in Western Australia.
But I think in hindsight, when I look back on my work, I realise, especially having moved away from Western Australia, that it does have a very distinctive West Australian feel.
Also on the show, 10 bucks for a coffee, how the psychology of exchange rates influences our holiday spending, and in our daily monologue, Monocle's Marcus Hippie explains the endearing quality of the world's Nordic peoples to stick together.
Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Norway and Iceland allowed Nordic citizens to move and settle freely already 60 years ago. It is kind of a shame that all this Nordic stuff has been slightly neglected now that everyone is so consumed with the EU.
All that plus our selection of some of the best music around. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first we can catch up on the latest world news headlines with Roger Crisp.
Monocle 24 News. The UNHCR says that more than 214,000 Syrian refugees are now registered in neighbouring countries, with up to 5,000 a day arriving in Turkey and numbers of arrivals in Jordan having doubled. UNHCR spokeswoman Melissa Fleming gave these details.
Well, the numbers are significantly increasing as the fighting escalates in the town of Dara and then the surrounding villages. So we're seeing a spike in numbers. And disturbingly, we're also seeing among those many more unaccompanied children. So children who say that their parents have died and they've gone off on their own and crossed the border. Others who are saying that they've been just sent off on their own. So the numbers increasing and the profile of the people fleeing is changing.
Meanwhile, in Syria itself, 12 people were killed and dozens wounded when a car bomb exploded today at a funeral in Damascus in an attack that an activist group said had targeted supporters of President Bashar al-Assad. Tropical Storm Isaac is being upgraded to hurricane status and could reach New Orleans as early as Tuesday night, almost 7 years to the day since the city was devastated by Hurricane Katrina. President Obama has declared a state of emergency in Louisiana. His state governor, Bobby Jindal.
This storm, like every other storm, is nonpartisan. This is a time where we must all come together to fight the storm and work hard to protect our families and our property. After the storm is over, after we've gotten back up on our feet, there'll be plenty of time to talk about politics and political speeches. But the bottom line is that's all we're going to talk about that. That's all I'm going to say about that. What's more important is we focus on the business at hand.
Indeed, heeding these sentiments, farmers at the heart of the U.S. poultry industry are taking serious precautions, already stockpiling fuel and testing generators. Storm-related damage to agricultural industries after Hurricane Katrina topped $2 billion when farms were destroyed, processing plants were shut down, and high winds crushed chicken houses and killed flocks. In West Africa, Senegalese President Macky Sall joined international appeals for neighbouring Gambia to halt a series of planned executions of death row prisoners, confirming today that two of nine who have already faced the firing squad were Senegalese. Gambian President Yahya Jammeh vowed this month to execute all of more than 40 death row inmates by mid-September. The family of an American pro-Palestinian activist killed by an Israeli army bulldozer in 2003 says it will appeal against a court ruling that Israeli forces are not to blame for her death when she was defending Palestinian homes against demolition. An army investigation had cleared Israeli forces of blame, so her parents brought a civil case for negligence against Israel's defense ministry. The judge rejected their claim, a decision condemned by Rachel's mother, Cindy.
We are, of course, deeply saddened and deeply troubled by what we heard today from Judge Oded Gershon in the Haifa District Court. I believe that this was a bad day not only for our family, but a bad day for human rights, for humanity, for the rule of law, and also for the country of Israel.
Venezuela confirmed today that firefighters have completely extinguished a blaze at the country's largest oil refinery and which killed nearly 50 people. Earlier in the day, a fire at a third fuel storage tank restarted after the flames appeared to have been put out. However, the new blaze was quickly brought under control and extinguished. And Lufthansa passengers are facing hundreds of flight cancellations after the collapse of last-ditch pay talks between management and unions representing flight attendants. The union, which represents 18,000 flight attendants, says it is planning strike action over the next few weeks and that strikes will be called at only a few hours' notice. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Roger. And Roger will be back with the news headlines at the bottom of the hour in about 25 minutes' time. 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Desde Londres, esto es Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vas à Monocle 24.
De Londres, vous écoutez Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
位于伦敦,
London から,
from London,
Monocle 24 です.
This is Monocle 24.
24. Desde Londres, esto es Monocle 24.
4. Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One. Now, it's been a conflict that's waged for nearly 50 years. The Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC rebel group, have run a violent campaign since 1964. But following thousands of deaths on both rebel and government sides, a ceasefire could at last be in sight. Yesterday, Colombia's president, Juan Manuel Santos, announced that the government will be holding formal peace talks with the FARC on neutral ground, raising hopes of one of the world's longest running guerrilla wars could soon be at an end. Well, I'm delighted to say we're joined in the studio live here at Midori House by Colombian Ambassador to the UK, Mauricio Rodriguez Monera. Welcome to Monocle 24, Ambassador. Tell us, what is the context, the background behind President Santos' announcement yesterday?
Well, I think that President Santos is interpreting the desire of 46 million Colombians that want to end as soon as possible this conflict that has been taking place for almost half a century. And now Colombia has made a lot of progress in economic, social, and political matters, and we need to settle this situation once and for all.
And talking of progress, what's been the progress that has allowed these talks even to be considered? Because there have been attempts at ceasefires and talks in the past.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I would say, in first place, the opening of political space for the participation of all type of ideologies in the electoral contest. And for example, the mayor of Bogota, in this moment, the capital of Colombia, he used to be part of a guerrilla group and he was elected by popular vote. So that means that Colombia is a very robust democracy and it's ready to have all type of different opinions and different political perspectives. And that should encourage the FARC to abandon arms and participate in the political contest. I would say also that the social reforms, very progressive agenda of President Santos in really, really fighting against inequality and social injustice that during many, many years was a big problem in Colombia. And we've made tremendous progress in recent years. So that demonstrates that there's a commitment to overcome these traditional difficulties in my country. And last but not least, I would say the economy, which is now doing very well. We have plenty of domestic and foreign investment is allowing public finances to invest in social priorities such as housing, education, health, and that is allowing Colombia to take out of poverty millions of citizens.
Well, that's an interesting point you make about the current government's policies, which have actually led towards this position that we have. Would talks with the FARC have been potential ceasefire? Would have been unthinkable maybe 15, 20 years ago?
15 years ago, the FARC guerrilla was very strong. And in fact, they controlled almost one third of the Colombian territory. In that moment, Colombia's military was weak. The institutions were not strong enough. The economy was not doing well. There was no investment. There was no future. There was no hope. In fact, Colombia was declared by Foreign Policy magazine and think tank a failing state. So the guerrilla had no incentive to negotiate a peace agreement. But after a very, very important job done by President Uribe, the previous president of Colombia, in giving back security to Colombians, now the guerrilla realized that they cannot access power through arms and that they have a political opportunity and they should take it.
Mm. Now, before we talk about some of the mechanics of where and how these talks will take place, I want to ask you about potential stumbling blocks, which is some of the criminal activity that the FARC actually are involved in. How much of a difficulty is that, considering their reported involvement in the drugs trade?
Yeah, that's a serious obstacle because, unfortunately, the FARC have been involved in kidnappings, have been involved in narco-traffic, and therefore one issue of this discussion, this potential peace process should be how to deal with these crimes for a future solution of the conflict. And that will be part of the agenda. But on the other hand, we must also take into account that President Santos has been able to get the approval of Congress of the legal framework for peace, which gives him lots of legal instruments to deal with a potential solution to the conflict.
Well, that's crucial, isn't it? Because you need to have, presumably, and tell us how important it is to have agreement on frameworks from everybody, what we call the stakeholders involved in what a very delicate process it's sure to be.
It's very delicate, it's very complex, and it has enemies. The extreme right and the extreme left, violent political actors that have been against the peace processes in the past and are in favor of violence, will try to abort this process. So it's going to be difficult. But President Santos is a very strong leader, has lots of popular support, has lots of credibility, has the international support, and we hope that this time the conditions are, if not ideal, are at least the best that Colombia has faced in many years. So we're going to give it our best try.
So people are generally positive that we can get, as we say, bring about the end of an era in what's been a long-running blight on Colombia's society.
According to polls conducted in Colombia last week, 75% of Colombians support peace conversations. And we believe that that we are in a good position to achieve that negotiation, that agreement, because the FARC realized nowadays that they will not access power through the arms, and the government has made lots of political, economic, and social reforms to justify the end of the guerrilla and to invite them to participate in politics, as the M19, a former guerrilla group in Colombia, 20 years ago decided to give up arms and engage in a political conversation, and they are doing quite well. So Colombia is a democracy that's very plural. It's open to voices from all sides, and we want to end once and for all the violent methods of doing politics in Colombia that unfortunately have meant for Colombia a very, very a high price in terms of lives lost and billions of dollars wasted in a war, billions that should have been invested in social priorities.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned social priorities, because how much do you feel this is a generational change, that some of the young generations coming up have just had enough of it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Enough. After half a century of fighting, we need to realize that we are not going to completely defeat the guerrillas by a military solution that could take many more years. Now they are weak, but they are not defeated. And they still have the capacity to do some harm through terrorist acts. And the guerrilla has to realize that it will never access power through arms. So let's be practical. Let's realize that the best solution is to negotiate an agreement that will allow all Colombians from different political viewpoints to participate in democracy and to change things through democracy.
And if we just finally, Ambassador, talk about the timetable, we're expecting, I think the Vice President announced that talks would start in October in Oslo. I think that's correct.
No? There is no official statement in relation to the place and the timeline of these talks. There's some speculation, and yes, Cuba has been mentioned, Norway has been mentioned, but President Santos has not yet made any official announcement. But he has said that we hope to engage in those conversations as soon as possible, and that the objective is to end the conflict, of course, as soon as possible.
Mm. And is location important? Interesting that Europe was mentioned as well as Havana, Cuba.
Yes, location could eventually be important because it needs to give confidence to the parties involved that they will be able to engage in a conversation without any inconvenient pressures. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that President Santos and his delegates and the guerrilla leaders will find out a convenient solution in terms of time and in terms of location. And we are, as government, trying to do everything possible to facilitate those negotiations. There's a lot of goodwill from President Santos. From day one of his government, he said that he dreams with bringing peace to Colombia, and now he has taken a very, very bold step in the right direction.
Indeed so, and it's a fascinating story and one we'll be following very closely here on Monocle 24. But thank you very much for coming in, Ambassador Monera. That's Mauricio Rodriguez Monera, Colombian ambassador to the United Kingdom. You're listening to Midori House.
What Cannes is to film and Venice to architecture, the city of Arles is to photography. Our Monocle film crew headed down to the south of France for the opening week of the Rencontre d'Arles, the world's leading photography festival.
Photographers love a group hug. There's a lot of talk of apertures and shutter speeds and white balance in bars and parties across town. Everyone's at it, shooting everything in sight. Everyone's got their eye on everything and how everyone else might be framing it for a shot. It's a life through a lens in Arles.
Monocle Films, focus on photography on monocle.com.
Inspirational mayors, money-making gentrifiers, park creators, subway planners, tech hub upstarts, wayfinding geniuses, broom-toting road sweepers, stadium designers, all-seeing historians, and squawking birds. If they help make a city, you'll meet them on The Urbanist, Monocle's weekly show about the cities we live in that's presented by me, Andrew Tuck.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, where it's just gone 19 minutes past the hour. Now, Norwegian Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg has today apologised for shortcomings in the police response to Anders Breivik's murder of 69 people on Utøya Island and his bomb attack in central Oslo, killing 8 people just over 12 months ago. In his trial, Breivik had told the court that he had expected to be killed by police. Instead, their bungled response allowed him to extend his rampage for more than an hour before officers eventually reached the scene on Utøya Island. Well, joining us on the line from Oslo is Kjersti Løken Stavrum, our journalist at Aftenposten. Hello, Kjersti.
Hello.
Now, just outline, if you can, what it was that Stoltenberg ostensibly was apologising for. And was he talking on behalf of the police or on behalf of the government, or both?
This time he spoke on behalf of the government and on the political system, I think. And he, of course, had to apologize. I think he just really had to, after we had this inquiry recently with a very substantial report showing and documenting that we were absolutely unprepared for a terrorist attack, although there had been warnings and there should have been more preparations done.
Now, the report, as you say, was pretty damning and certainly didn't mince its words when it came to its criticism of the police's response.
Absolutely. And also the fact that the Prime Minister himself in 2002, in 2007 was asked very specifically that he should close the Grubbegata, the street where Anders Behring Breivik drove his car up close into the Prime Minister's building. And he was warned that it would be more than 50% chance that there would be a terror attack in that road. And he declined closing the road.
Yes, indeed. And that's not the only story.
There are several critical points.
Indeed, and the only one about the police helicopter, which couldn't be used because its crew was on vacation.
Yeah, and still it wouldn't be used because it wouldn't be able to carry police officers anyway. So I think the fact is that not only did the inquiry show or demonstrate that we were not sufficiently prepared, it has also come out that during the past 12 months, the police and also the political system, the government, has really tried to spin away from the fact that they were not really managing the plans as they should have. So they have really put a lot of rhetoric into how they handled the 22nd of July. But when this inquiry went deeper into the facts, it turned out that things were not as they have said that they were.
Mm. Have there been any mitigating factors in the police's response, in that either people or process or the fact they just hadn't had anything like this happen before?
No, we have never ever been any close to this. Not since the Second World War has anything like this happened in Norway. So of course we have no experience about this. But on the other hand, Norway has troops in Afghanistan. We're part of NATO, and it's not that we haven't been threatened with the terrorist attacks. So we are also part of the world, and we should have been better prepared.
Indeed. Now, tell us about the plan that Jens Stoltenberg has put before Parliament, his revealing of a plan to deal with future crises like this.
Yeah, well, today I do think that my impression is that the leaders of the other political parties, they needed to hear a Prime Minister deeply regretting the fact that they were not able to protect the citizens. And they also find that the means now on this plan is not really of that interest today, and they also criticize them for not having a time schedule for this these means that is being taken now.
Oh, well, the timescale is an interesting point, isn't it? Because delay seems to have been a characteristic of not only the police response in the first place, but also apportioning, finding out exactly what went wrong, and then actioning any of the information from those discoveries.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a paradox, and an even greater paradox today is that we find ourselves with a government that is very weakened because of this. I mean, we had this poll in the weekend showing that the Conservative Party, the opposition party, has all-time high on the polls, and the Labour Party is declining. And the paradox is that it was, of course, the Labour Party that Anders Behring Breivik wanted to attack, and now they have sort of been a victim for their own mishandling all the things.
Mm. Okay, well, just finally, if we can, Kirsty, can we just talk a bit in wider terms about the Breivik sentence itself? To many people who perhaps don't understand the intricacies and subtleties of the Norwegian justice system, 21 years didn't seem like a very long time. Can you just explain, does that mean 21 years or is it effectively a life sentence?
It will effectively be a lifetime sentence. Because we have this specific law saying that if it's somehow judged that you will still be a danger to the society, there will be a consideration made by the police every year after 21 years, considering that if you're able to be released into the society or not. And and the judge, she said when she put the sentence that after 21 years, then the society that Anders Behring Breivik hates will still be there. And that's why I think that most of us are pretty sure that we won't meet him outside the jail again.
Mm. So it wasn't actually possible, or were there provisions in the law to give a longer sentence, even though effectively he's never going to come out?
Yeah, it's strange. And of course, already the debate has started also in Norway. Should we have lifetime sentence for crimes of this large scale? But it's not very many people in Norway who think that we should have lifetime sentence.
Mm. Well, that's an interesting point, and perhaps one we can look at later. That's all we've got time for. But thank you very much, Kirsti Løken Stavrum, journalist at Aftenposten, joining us there from Oslo. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 01:27 a.m. in Singapore, 18:27 here in London, and 13:27 in New York City. Let's continue with some music from Finland. This is Regina with Unessa. Was Unessa by Regina. Now, in the next half hour of Midori House, we'll be discussing who seems to be the winners and losers in Holland's general election campaign, with the election itself just weeks away. And we'll also be speaking to renowned Australian illustrator Sean Tan, and be finding out why exchange rates can influence whether you spend more or less than you expected on your summer holidays. But first, here's Roger Crisp with the news headlines.
Thanks, Ted. The UNHCR says that more than 214,000 Syrian refugees are now registered in neighbouring countries, with up to 5,000 a day arriving in Turkey, and numbers of arrivals in Jordan having doubled. Meanwhile, in Syria itself, 12 people were killed and dozens wounded when a car bomb exploded today at a funeral in Damascus, in an attack that an activist group said had targeted supporters of President Bashar al-Assad. Tropical storm Isaac is being upgraded to hurricane status, meaning that it is reaching wind speeds of at least 120 kilometres per hour and could reach New Orleans as early as tonight, almost 7 years to the day since the city was devastated by Hurricane Katrina. In West Africa, Senegalese President Macky Sall joined international appeals for neighbouring Gambia to halt a series of planned executions of all death row prisoners, confirming today that two of nine who've already faced the firing squad were Senegalese. The family of an American pro-Palestinian activist killed by an Israeli army bulldozer in 2003 says it will appeal against a court ruling that Israeli forces are not to blame for her death when she was defending Palestinian homes against demolition. Venezuela confirmed today that firefighters have completely extinguished a blaze at the country's largest oil refinery, and which killed nearly 50 people. And Lufthansa passengers are facing hundreds of flight cancellations after the collapse of last-ditch pay talks between management and unions representing flight attendants. And those are the headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Roger, and more news at the top of the hour. Now, campaigning ahead of Holland's general election next month has thrown up an unlikely kingmaker. Emiel Roemer, leader of the Dutch Socialist Party, is drawing the kind of support in the opinion polls that could see his party take up to a quarter of the seats in Parliament. As in France, the socialists in Holland and their rejection of austerity measures such as welfare cuts are proving very popular. But how could they fit into any coalition? Well, Thomson Reuters bureau chief in the Netherlands is Sarah Webb, and she's covering the Dutch election campaign there. Joins us on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Now, tell us about Roemer. What do we know about him? What kind of a man is he?
Well, he seems to have come from nowhere. He's a school teacher by background. He's been in local politics. He's listed Silence of the Lambs as one of his favourite films on his on the Socialist Party website.
Okay, has that drawn support in itself, or is just informs us of the kind of movies he likes?
Oh, what it conveys is that he's a very ordinary man, and that's what appeals to a lot of voters in this election. He's very down to earth when he talks on television. He's just a normal guy.
And if, as you say, a former school teacher.
Yes.
And has that been any kind of anti-politician sentiment? Is a kind of, I'm not one of them, I'm one of you?
Well, he is, as I said, Mr. Normal, Mr. Ordinary. He has been in local politics. And what's interesting there is that the Socialist Party has had to work in coalition with other parties. So he does have some experience at local government level of working with even a party on the right, the Liberal Party, Mark Rutte, Prime Minister Mark Rutte's party. And while it's very different, you know, at local level, you're dealing with things like schools and sewage and infrastructure, you know, and potholes in the roads. What will be quite difficult is for him to form a coalition, if he does indeed win the most seats, with other parties, because obviously at national level you're dealing with issues like tax policy, Europe, the euro, saving Greece, all these sort of bigger issues. So that will be quite an interesting test.
Indeed. And talking about bigger issues, just give us a picture of how the election campaign has been going. Obviously, since the last government collapsed earlier this year after Geert Wilders pulled out of the coalition.
Well, in fact, the Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, has been running the country since then. As you say, the government collapsed in April over the budget talks. But within a matter of days, the Finance Minister had managed to pull together a budget agreement. And the caretaker government has been running the country. And the election campaign really just kicked off a week or so ago and is, you know, warming up ahead of the election on September the 12th.
And talking of Wilders, as I did a little earlier, his Freedom Party takes a pretty no-nonsense approach to the euro in that they're not interested in it. How much traction will he have this time round?
Yes, as you say, he's probably the hardest on the euro. He wants the Netherlands to pull out of the euro, return to the guilder, pull out of the European Union. I mean, he's really at the extreme on this issue. This does appeal to some Dutch, it has to be said. You know, when you look at the issues facing the Netherlands at the moment, the Dutch are frugal and thrifty. They've seen their money, their taxes go to bailing out countries like Greece and increasingly other countries in the Eurozone. And at the same time, they've had to really tighten their belts and put up with a lot of budget cuts. As the country has to meet the EU budget deficit targets, so they've really felt that they've given a lot to rescuing these countries in Europe, and that they've had to sacrifice quite a lot in terms of their own welfare state.
Okay, so
his views do resonate with some voters, but I would say probably they're in the minority. Although the polls tend to show that, you know, perhaps 40% or so pine for the guilder, even if they aren't actually saying let's get out of the euro.
Yeah. Okay. So just finally and briefly, Sarah, do you think Roemer, who we began speaking about, actually has the capability of playing kingmaker?
Well, that's a tough call because, as I said, he has shown he's able to work in a coalition and to compromise at the local government level, but he is untested at national level. And he will find it extremely difficult to form a coalition to get a majority in Parliament. He will probably have to turn to four or five different parties. And they don't share his views on austerity and Europe. So it will be very difficult. We'll probably have weeks, if not months, of coalition formation ahead of us.
I'm sure we'll all look forward to that, as will you. Well, thank you very much for the time being, Sarah. That's Sarah Webb, Thomson Reuters Bureau Chief in the Netherlands there. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with one of Australia's most famous children's illustrators.
The September issue of Monocle is a global survey of flashpoints and fighting forces. In this inaugural defence-themed issue, our editors put on their flak jackets and pop on their helmets as they investigate everything from how to create a modern fighting force to how to design state-of-the-art camouflage. And we have lots more to offer too.
In the affairs section, we climb on board the USS George Washington to see why aircraft carriers still rule the waves. We head to Norway to visit the world's best officer training school. And I nip over to Brussels to interview Anders Fogh Rasmussen, Secretary General of NATO.
In the business section this month, we go inside the studios of America's leading camouflage designers. We take a look at the big businesses that have surprising defence interests, and we report on the major deals taking place at Farnborough this year. We also have our first entrepreneur's guide, a comprehensive look at how to set up shop. The battle-ready September issue of Monocle is on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
No food, no battle. Monocle Films attends Kitchen Boot Camp to witness operational excellence in the field of the culinary arts.
We really try to provide to the last moment fresh food to our troopers. While other armies, they start quickly to eat out of tins and they just are distributing survival packages or bags where you add some hot water. We really try to serve good, healthy food based on fresh products, even on the front line.
You can watch this film and many more from affairs to business, culture to design in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Now, if you're sitting comfortably, we'll begin. The children's book world has been in London this week for the 33rd World Congress of the International Board on Books for Young People. Amongst the storytellers, there was the renowned Australian illustrator Sean Tan. Now, Tan is probably best known for directing the Academy Award-winning short film The Lost Thing and for receiving the prestigious Astrid Lindgren Award for his contribution to international children's literature. Well, Monocle's Adrian Craddock spoke to Sean, who happens to be his countryman and near neighbour, in London earlier this week.
You and I have something in common, actually. We're both from the same state. We're from Western Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Has that played any role in your work? I mean, there's always this kind of sense of almost isolation in your illustrations. Is it fair to say kind of the city of Perth and the state of Western Australia kind of has a lot to do with your work?
Yeah, I think so. It's not something that I reference consciously. So, for instance, I grew up reading a lot of Tim Winton, another writer who sort of partly grew up in the adjacent suburb to me. And he's a writer that really focuses directly on that landscape. I don't, because a lot of my work is set in a displaced universe and it often involves science fiction and fantasy or magic realist elements. I guess I grew up also in Perth drawing and writing as a way of escaping my suburban reality. I'm sure you understand.
Yeah,
what
it's
that's
definitely
like.
A very suburban place. That you can
yeah,
kind of...
and isolated.
Yeah,
and isolated.
Yeah.
And I didn't really travel outside of Western Australia until I was in my mid-20s, really. So, you end up having quite an isolated mentality. But I think in hindsight, when I look back on my work, I realise, especially having moved away from Western Australia, that it does have a very distinctive West Australian feel.
At the moment in Fremantle, there's an exhibition on, is that right, of your work?
Yes, yeah, there was just recently, and that was... interestingly relates to your first question because it was all paintings of suburban landscapes, which is pretty much where I cut my teeth as an artist just going out and painting things immediately around me that were very familiar. So quite different from the work I'm more well known for now, which is books and weird stories. This is very much straight impressionistic painting of my local landscape.
And some of the pieces that were in that exhibition focused on the film that you actually won an Oscar for.
Yes.
That must have been an amazing moment in your career. How's that changed your career?
Not as much as you'd think. I guess it's one of those things where if you're craving an award and you're planning on an award as a stepping stone in a career, then it's quite a dramatic thing. It's like a door opening. For me, I'd already been working by then for over 15 years as a picture book illustrator and writer in a very quiet way, so starting off in Perth quite anonymously. And I think I had time to find out what I really liked doing. And so the film venture was a bit of a side project at first, which then became quite consuming. But once it was finished, it still feels like a tangent to where my head it really is. And winning an Oscar was even more of a tangent. It was just a bizarre, oblique divergence.
Were you actually at the ceremony?
Yeah, sure. I was accepting the thing on behalf of the team. So yeah. It was quite nerve-wracking.
Yeah. I mean, that must have been an absolutely, as you say, surreal experience. Coming from, this isolated city as we're talking about.
I can't emphasise it enough. I mean, you sort of say that to people, oh, it was surreal. And they're like, yeah, right, we can see that. But it's quite different when you're actually there because it felt like walking into a parallel reality in which I have to say I didn't really feel like I belonged. Like by some freak of the universe, I was able to be at this event and exit quite rapidly. It's quite a short thing. And then come home to my little hobbit hole and think, what was that all about?
You've been quite outspoken about the way you work. Some people find satisfaction in working like a busy place, maybe in an office, but
sure.
You're quite particular about the way that you work. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I guess I'm not particular. I just know what works and what doesn't. I love working actually collaboratively in a group. I've been involved with a few theatre projects and of course the film, and that's great fun, like this, being able to have a conversation, and it actually can speed up the creative process. Because there's an element of objectivity when you get more than one person discussing. But when it comes to really knocking out creative ideas, I find I have to be almost in a state of extreme tranquility or boredom. So I have the sensitivity to the vague subtleness of most creative ideas, because the good ideas don't hit you like a hammer. They kind of creep almost like a distracting thought at the edge of your other conscious, more intelligent thoughts.
Sure.
And letting it in is sometimes difficult, I find, in a situation where you have to think about other things like people and logistics. It's much like dreaming. You can only sort of dream well when you're quite sedated. And that's how I find is the case when I'm in the studio.
So you're in London this week for an event for the International Board on Books for Young People. And you were giving a keynote lecture, is that right? What kind of stuff were you asked to talk about?
Well, I was actually talking quite a bit about Perth because I'm always mindful coming to Europe of the strange journey of from drawing in your suburban bedroom in Perth without any conception that you'll ever leave that space to suddenly speaking at this international conference, which is just bizarre. I guess about the fact that I'm mixed race, so I'm half Chinese, half Australian, whatever Australian means. In my case, on my mother's side, English and Irish, with very complicated family history like most people, and growing up in a really new suburb of Western Australia. So, I mean, Hillary's at the time in the 70s and 80s was still being developed. And so it was almost like I grew up in a place that felt like I was really transplanted and had no cultural or historical or genetic relationship.
At the time, it would have been right on the edge of Perth, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was. There were a few suburbs further north, but not many. You have to imagine a sandy coastal plain, somewhat windswept at times, upon which these European-looking houses are being built. Mm. So I think that's kind of marked my consciousness, and I think it's a relevant thing to talk about, especially, I start to realise when I'm away from home how exotic my home actually is. We don't realise it until we're away.
Well, that was children's book illustrator and Oscar winner Sean Tan speaking to Monocle's Adrian Craddock. And there's an extended version of that interview on next week's edition of The Culture with Rob Bound, premiering next Monday, 1900 hours London time. Past the hour, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, according to a new research document, the amount of money tourists spend abroad depends almost entirely on whether they're getting more bang for their buck, courtesy of a favourable exchange rate. The conversion rate's psychological effect is so strong, indeed, that it's making the difference between having to buy another suitcase to transport your purchases back home, or getting on the plane at the end of your trip, wondering why that last cappuccino just cost four times what you pay for it back home. Well, to learn more about the logic behind our reactions to exchange rates, we're joined by on the line by Priya Raghubir, Research Professor of Marketing at the Stern School of Business at the NYU, New York University. Hello, Professor.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. Thank you very much for joining us. Tell us about some of the conclusions that the NYU report, the research, actually came up with.
This is work which I did with my colleagues Vicky Morwitz and Shelley Santana, and we were very interested in examining what was going to happen in Europe after many of the countries moved to the euro. Based on some earlier work which I had done with another colleague of mine, Joydeep Srivastava, who's at Maryland, we had documented something called the face value effect, which is that people underspend in countries where the exchange rate is a multiple of their home currency. So, for example, an American traveling to France before the euro would likely to have underspent because prices would have been expressed in French franc terms, and the French franc is a multiple of the US dollar. Mm. However, after they moved to the euro, the reverse happened all over Europe, except in with the Irish punt. The Irish punt remained a fraction of the euro, whereas all other currencies were a multiple. So we were really examining whether people in Europe were likely to be overspending compared to what they had been spending earlier, given that prices were now quoted in euros rather than Deutschmark, French franc, lira, and so on.
And what happened? Presumably, you're saying that people were spending more because they weren't faced with something, say they'd gone to Italy, that was 50,000 lira.
Well, exactly. So it's a bit of a sticker shock you get, even though a part of you is able to do the math and figure out that, look, this is exactly the same amount of money. But just seeing 50,000 whatever makes you say, wow, that's a lot of money. And that is what gets you to underspend. By the same token, if you are in a country where the exchange rate is a fraction of yours, then the reverse happens. You would say, ah, this is just one something, without realizing that that one something translates into exactly X number of your local currency.
Indeed. And do people really find that that fraction element prevents them from buying more things? When it's easy when you think there's, say, £1 means $1.6, but in the other way, it must be more expensive for Americans coming and feeling that they're not getting so much bang for their buck.
Well, right now, of course, there is the actual exchange rate itself, which is changing. There's a lot of stuff happening in Europe with the uncertainty about the economy and so on. And those are not issues that we are specifically looking at in this. Ours is much more to look at the psychological impact of the way currencies are framed, which makes a huge big difference.
And what is it? Where does it go to, in your estimation? What part of the brain is it? Is it just that we go on holiday and we want to spend some money, we want to have a good time, but we don't want to feel that we're going to be getting back home, having a look at our credit card statement and realizing the cold, hard numbers that we spent much more than we expected to?
Right. And that's another issue. When one is away on vacation, one seems to get into this hyper mode of accounting, which one doesn't do at home. You at home, you know, certain things cost a certain amount. But if the minute you're out with friends on a vacation, you start accounting for every little expense that you've had, which is very, very bizarre. And I think it comes from a fear of overspending. So a lot of these things come from you're trying to keep control of your spending in a situation where spending is foreign to you because of the foreign currency. And so you are hyper-accounting and you're keeping track of these expenses. But the minute you put things on a credit card, you do not have what we call pain of paying. And that comes from other research, which I've also done with Joydeep Srivastav, where the pain of paying means that you don't really get that initial feeling of cash, you know, the pain which you get, actual physical pain, when cash leaves your wallet.
Mm.
And therefore, you don't notice how much you're paying when you put money on a credit card.
Indeed not. But if you're like me, Professor, you just can't help yourself when you go to somewhere like Japan. You actually leave space in your luggage for all the stuff you're going to bring back.
Absolutely. And, you know, prices in Japan are super expensive. And one would think that with the yen conversion rate that one would end up spending less than one would have thought. My favorite example is people going to India. And they go to India, and India, you know, right now I think the exchange rate is something like 45 or 50 or 55, and we actually use that in some of our studies. And they see a pashmina shawl, and it's 1,000 rupees. And 1,000 rupees is really $20. It's really cheap. But they will not buy it because, oh, it's 1,000. So it's just the face value effect which kicks in and gets people to behave or spend less than they would have spent had the face value effect not been there.
Indeed so. Okay, well, thank you very much. That's fascinating, Professor. That's Professor Priya Raghubir from the Stern School of Business at the New York University. Now, before we hit the road on today's Midori House, time for our daily monologue. On a week when, as we've been hearing in the programme, Norway's Prime Minister apologised for his police force's handling of the Utøya Island shootings, Monocle's Marcus Hippie has been reflecting on the emotional ties that bind Nordic people together.
It's good for small countries to stick together. Now everyone thinks I'm going to start going on about the European Union, whereas I actually want to talk about the smaller union of Nordic countries that was already formed decades before European integration became a hot topic. Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Norway and Iceland allowed Nordic citizens to move and settle freely already 60 years ago. It is kind of a shame that all this Nordic stuff has been slightly neglected now that everyone is so consumed with the EU. But something still remains about the Nordic connection. The small northern countries have been sticking together in many things and trying to put up against what the bigger countries want with the EU. But what I find more important in the Nordic cooperation is that at the same time it's something more personal. Sometimes the Nordic embassies are housed in same building complexes. Often they help also the citizens of their neighboring countries, making everyone's life a bit easier. I spent the other night with a couple of Danes. I got a reminder of how much more beneficial this idea of supporting each other can be. My Danish acquaintance's mother was working in Spain when there was a disastrous bus accident years ago, where 9 Finnish tourists lost their lives. When this happened, it was not just the Finnish community in Spain, but also Danes, Swedes and Norwegians that started furiously working to locate and support the Finns who had been in the bus in a state of shock after the accident, some of them injured and spread around hospitals in southern Spain. There was invaluable help in a moment of crisis, and this all happened largely for solidarity, not for obligational reasons. And then there is Nordic cooperation on the level of individuals. I have never believed the claims that the character of the Nordic people is somehow naturally more trustworthy and honest. I think the lower crime rates are just a matter of fact of smaller income gaps and more communal feeling that comes as a result of living in smaller places. Quite frankly, your neighbor tends to know quite well what you are up to. And yes, you can also get robbed in the north as well. But there is something that the Nordic people share, regardless of which country in the north they happen to be from. It is the same approach to the world after having looked at it from the northern, rather isolated angle for years. The need for space and high appreciation for weird cuisine such as salted licorice, meatballs and fish. Crayfish and vodka shots quickly melt all the language differences away, and we can then start laughing at all the stupid stereotypes that we have of each other, such as Norwegians being a bit thick, Finns always carrying knives, and that all the Swedes are homosexuals. It is comforting to know that there are people around you who think the same way. Sometimes, when I get bored, I entertain myself by heading to one of the busiest market streets in London, spotting Nordic citizens. Be it the blonde looks, language, or socks in sandals, I feel that I am not far away from home. For Monocle, I am Markus Hippi.
Good stuff. Well, that's all we have time for today. Midori House was indeed produced by Markus Hippi. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next after the news is this week's episode of our design show, Section D. In 3 hours' time, Dominic Reynolds and Tamsin Smith will be back here live with the Monocle Daily and Rob Bounds here with Midori House, same time, same place tomorrow. But for now, I'm Ted Kravitz. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.